You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the United States, approximately 100,000 inmates are being held in solitary confinement, which is defined as being shut up in an 8x10 windowless room for 23 to 24 hours a day. Some inmates are kept in solitary for decades. As part of his study of prison conditions over the past 40 years, Dr. Terry Allen Coopers has interviewed thousands of inmates to understand the effect that solitary confinement has had on them. In his latest book, Solitary, The Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It, he looks into the history of this form of punishment and suggests ways it can be stopped. His book is published by University of California Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Terry Allen Coopers to our show. Hello.
Hello. Happy to be with you.
You're a forensic psychiatrist. What does that mean in terms of what we're talking about?
Well, in psychiatry, forensic psychiatrist means the interface of psychiatry and the law.
So that has allowed you to go behind the scenes in the supermax prison facilities?
Yes. I serve as an expert witness in class action litigation, challenging the constitutionality of conditions of confinement. In the beginning of my career, it was crowding and how crowding causes an increase in violence and mental breakdown. But in the 80s, what I call a historic wrong turn occurred, and the authorities started locking people, more and more people, into solitary confinement as a way to control uncontrollable prisons.
You said crowding, but you also were originally concerned with sexual abuse, the quality of correctional mental health treatment in prisons, and they still remain concerns of yours.
Those problems are still very prevalent. They're all interconnected. So, for instance, a disproportionate number of people with mental illness end up in solitary confinement, which is more harsh and damaging for them.
It's been noted that with the closing of many mental health facilities, the prisons have become our new mental health facilities. Are they prepared?
Well, you're absolutely right, and no, they're not. In fact, people with mental illness in prison are basically tortured. The prison authorities are not ready to handle people with mental illness. Their mental illness gets worse, more chronic, and more difficult to treat.
They are dealt with in a couple of different ways, either put into special facilities or just left with the rest of the prison population. Are there positives or negatives from both of those approaches?
Well, both occur. There are very dedicated mental health staff in the correction systems, and they do their best. But we've had a multiplication of 7 to 10 times the number of prisoners that we had in the 1970s. The mental health staff has not expanded accordingly. Meanwhile, the proportion of prisoners with serious mental illness, as you say, because of deinstitutionalization, also the war on drugs, where a lot of people with mental illness do substances and get locked up. And so what's happened is the population of prisoners with serious mental illness has exploded, but the treatment for them has not kept pace.
And some of them are suicidal. Are suicidal prisoners put into solitary confinement?
Yes, they are. And they're put into solitary repeatedly. So there's what I consider a cycle.
Well, wouldn't that exacerbate their depression?
Absolutely. Half of all the successful suicides in prison, and there are many more suicides in prison than out in the community, half of all the successful suicides in prison occur among the 4 or 6 or 8% of prisoners who are locked in solitary confinement.
You write about the overuse of drugs to treat inmates with mental health problems. Is that a result of understaffing of psychiatrists in prison?
Absolutely. A psychiatrist should only have a certain number of patients for whom he or she is prescribing. The American Psychiatric Association recommends 150. In many prison situations, a psychiatrist will have 1,000 prisoners who are his patients and he's prescribing for. It doesn't allow him enough time to really study the problem of the individual or to prescribe appropriately.
Or to engage in talk therapy.
Absolutely. Talk therapy is rare behind bars.
Would talk therapy be a good approach?
Yes, it would, but it's not possible to do that when someone is in solitary confinement. That's the problem.
What if a prisoner doesn't like the side effects of the drugs he's being given? Do they have any agency in their own care?
Well, in psychiatry, mostly what we do is listen carefully to people if we have frequent enough appointments and enough time, and we alter the prescribing so that there will be a minimum of side effects. In prison, the opposite is the case. The time between appointments with a psychiatrist is long. Meanwhile, the correction staff, the custody officers, punish prisoners for not taking the prescribed medication. So if a prisoner finds that the medication makes him sleep all day or makes him neurologically impaired, and he stops the medication on his own, which is a common problem in the community, he will get a disciplinary write-up in prison and probably be sent to solitary confinement.
After many decades of what have been perceived as failed policies in the U.S. prison system, wasn't there finally some bipartisan agreement to overhaul it? Did that all end when Donald Trump was elected?
Well, that's an interesting and complicated question. Yes, I think there was a consensus around the country for sentencing reform, to shorten sentences, which will do something about the prison overcrowding. Also, President Obama, Justice Kennedy made very strong statements about the harm of solitary confinement, and there was a move away from that. Donald Trump stands for exactly the opposite. He likes waterboarding. So he is going to, for instance, foster private prisons, which is where a lot of the abuses happen. At the same time, the states have figured out that it's better to cut down on solitary confinement. So a week or two ago, Rick Ramish, the director of the Colorado Department of Corrections, announced that they had gotten rid of solitary confinement in Colorado. So there are both tendencies.
You mentioned earlier that there's been an increase in the use of solitary confinement. When was it first introduced into the American prison system?
Well, solitary has been around since the beginning of the country. So Benjamin Franklin at the Walnut Street Jail in Philadelphia advocated being alone in a room. And he considered that an opportunity for the criminal to be penitent and change his ways. That program very quickly, and the Quakers were involved in that, that program very quickly deteriorated. The Walnut Street Jail became very crowded. There were several people in the room instead of one. Originally, the warden was supposed to come and talk to the person about how his penitence is going, and that's the origin of the word penitentiary. And they became warehouses, crowded with many, many prisoners, and the whole purpose of Benjamin Franklin was destroyed.
But at a certain point, it became obvious that this was not an opportunity for somebody to be penitent. It was really punishment.
That's right. They were warehousing people. And what happened as the jails and prisons became overcrowded, and there are waves. This happens over and over again in history. The correctional facilities become overcrowded, the violence gets out of control, there's a lot of mental breakdowns, and then there are reforms. In the 80s in the United States, when that happened, I and a number of people recommended reforms of downsizing the population and increasing the mental health treatment and the rehabilitation. The authorities that be ignored our advice and instead resorted to increasing percentages of prisoners in solitary confinement.
But hasn't the research shown that solitary doesn't achieve the desired outcome? So why are we increasing its use?
Well, that's exactly right, and that's a complicated question. Not only does solitary confinement exacerbate mental illness, and really it, in ways that are not entirely visible, creates harm even in very stable prisoners.
Does it matter whether they're kept in solitary for the full 24 hours of the day or whether they're let out for at least an hour?
There are standards in the country due to previous class action litigation where a prisoner in solitary anywhere in the country is supposed to have 5 hours a week out of their cell. In many locations, that is not followed. But yes, that does alleviate the problem a little. Still, it's torture and there's great harm.
45 years ago, in 1974, you toured the L.A. County Jail to prepare for testifying in a case that the ACLU was bringing about conditions in that jail. What did you see?
Well, that was a time of massive crowding. The war on drugs puts a lot of people behind bars. People with serious mental illness tend to be dually diagnosed. That is, they take illicit substances, presumably to help with their psychic pain.
They're self-medicating.
That's right. So what I saw was people basically on every inch of floor space. They were sleeping on top of the metal tables that they were supposed to be eating on. There were three or four people in a cell built for two. There was a dominance hierarchy where the tougher prisoners would get the bunk and the weaker prisoners would have to sleep on the floor. And there were a huge number of people with serious mental illness. Meanwhile, nobody got out of the pod of cells they were in, for instance, to do recreation or for any kind of mental health treatment.
So did the ACLU win that case?
They did win that case. That's called Rutherford versus Pitches. It's still being monitored, and there are still issues in the L.A. County Jail, but it's much improved. And right now, as we talk, they are going to tear down the Men's Central Jail in Los Angeles. And there is debate at the County Board of Supervisors whether to construct a mental health jail in its place.
How do the jails in Los Angeles compare to the jails in other cities?
I would say they're about comparable. Los Angeles County Jail is about comparable to Rikers Island, and same to Cook County in Chicago. It's a huge urban jail.
Well, Rikers has been a troubled place. Some years ago, I interviewed somebody whose brother had been sentenced to some time in Rikers, and he was young and cute, and there was concern that he might be preyed upon by sexual predators. And there was talk about whether he should try to get himself into solitary. And they decided that solitary might even be worse for him than fending for himself in the regular population.
It's a horrible no-win situation. And we see that all the time. In New York, it was age 16, I believe it's 17 now, that juveniles are tried as adults and sent to adult prisons. Juveniles in adult prisons are preyed upon, and yes, they either ask for protection, and that puts them in solitary, or according to the prison code, you're not supposed to show weakness. So instead of asking for protection, they go hit another prisoner or a guard. They get put in solitary. For them, that solves one problem, which is it takes them out of the way of sexual assault, but it causes another problem, and that is that the solitary confinement has a more harmful effect on juveniles than others. In New York, the New York Civil Liberties Union won a class action suit, so the juveniles cannot be put in solitary at Rikers Island anymore.
I'm speaking with Terry Allen Cooper, Professor Emeritus at the Wright Institute, and author of Solitary, The Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. In a chapter called A Culture of Punishment, you write about touring the Supermax unit at Mississippi State Penitentiary at Parchman. Hadn't a state-of-the-art facility, Unit 32, been built to hold the worst of the worst? What did you find there?
Well, the worst of the worst is a misnomer. There are maybe a handful of prisoners in the entire country that I would not feel safe being in a room alone with. But we have 100,000 people in solitary confinement. They're definitely not the worst of the worst. Many of them just ran into trouble with an officer and then they disciplined them, punished them by putting them in solitary. But they're certainly not particularly worse than anyone else.
So how much of this is because of the screening process being used to hire prison guards, and the fact that in many cases the prisons are in rural areas where all the prison guards will see this as the highest paying job available. They'll all be white, whereas many of the inmates are people of color.
Well, that's absolutely right what you're saying. And here I'll bring in the issue of sexual abuse. I've testified in many trials, class action, civil actions, about sexual abuse in women's prison, its staff sexually abusing or raping women prisoners.
Have male guards in women's prisons?
Absolutely. And that's generally how it happens. In men's prisons, sexual assault is prisoner on prisoner. In women's prisons, it's staff violating the women. if an officer is found to have sexually abused or raped a woman, he will be fired. He may or may not face criminal charges. If he crosses a border and applies to be a prison guard, he will probably be hired because of his past experience, and not much will be done to check his record. We absolutely should check the record for domestic violence, for criminal activity, before hiring officers, screen them so that we can feel confident they will be compassionate towards the prisoners, train them much, much better than they are currently trained, and then supervise them with a zero tolerance for any kind of abuse.
You write that in the supermax isolation unit, punishments become the main mode of intervention for custody staff, and prisoners' misbehavior is the trigger and rationale for these measures. What are some examples of the rules that are imposed on the prisoners that can lead to them being punished?
Well, once people are locked in solitary confinement, the power dynamics are that the officers have all the powers, the prisoners have none. If a prisoner is put in solitary, that's generally considered the worst punishment in the prison system. But then once in that punishment situation in solitary confinement, if they misbehave in any way, for instance, talking back to the officer, or refusing to return a food tray because there were bugs in the food and they want to talk to somebody about it, they will then be subjected to a cell extraction where five or six officers wearing padding all over their body, a helmet, a gas mask, will first spray them in through the food port in their cell door with immobilizing gas and then rush in and subdue them. The officers wear gas masks. They will slam them against the wall, usually with a plastic shield, and the prisoner gets beat up and hurt.
And you cite some other things that might cause them to be punished. Not waking up on time, not standing at attention during the count, walking beyond the lines that are drawn on the floor.
Yes.
These are really petty things, and yes, yet they lead to serious punishment?
Absolutely, and there's no one there watching. I mean, the society says lock them up and throw away the key. The color of their skin is an important issue. There's racial discrimination and outright racism in the prisons, in the entire criminal justice system. But with nobody looking, when the officers are white and they have African American or other prisoners of color, they will disproportionately send them to solitary confinement. And then in solitary confinement, those prisoners of color will be beat up, they'll be cell extracted, they'll be sprayed with immobilizing gas much more than other prisoners.
You're right that typically the progression of punishments begins with simple things. In some solitary confinement units, including the one in Pelican Bay State Prison, prisoners aren't permitted phone calls at all. But in other solitary units, the average prisoner is permitted phone calls. So when a prisoner misbehaves, phone privileges can be taken from them.
That's right. Or
now,
their commissary.
How important are phone calls?
I think it's a huge mistake to remove a phone calls or visits from prisoners. They are used for punishment. In a psychiatric hospital, when a patient gets into trouble, the first thing I want to do is talk to the family and find out if there's something going on outside, a divorce, a child in trouble, and arrange for family visits, maybe family therapy. In prison, it works the other way around. So the prisoner who is being punished is going to be deprived of contact with loved ones. That's going to make him or her more desperate and therefore more likely to break rules or get into violent altercations.
You write about an episode of excessive force by policy that occurred in the Montana Department of Corrections Behavioral Management Plan against a prisoner named Edward Walker. What happened?
Well, this was a high-profile case that went to the Montana Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in their opinion, said that it was torture what was happening. Once someone is put in solitary confinement, they have nothing. They have no activities. They're all by themselves. They have no one to talk to.
Can they get books?
Some can and some can't. Again, they take away books as a punishment, which is also foolhardy. So Mr. Walker, when faced with that kind of abusive situation, reacted by fighting back. So he would get angry at the officers, he'd yell at them, he'd refuse to return his food tray. once they have them in solitary confinement, which is the highest level of punishment, it's hard to create a worse punishment, but sure enough, the officers do it. So a behavior management plan involves taking away food and instead giving the person a crunched up supply of yesterday's leftovers, taking away bedding, taking away mattress, no pillow, no clothes, giving them a cover, and they sleep on the concrete plank where the bed should have gone. And they leave them there for days. And the idea is that if the person behaves for 2 days, they will give them their clothes back and their mattress. But in fact, most people can't behave in that kind of situation. They get upset, and then they get further punishment, which is a longer time with that kind of torture deprivation.
Dr. Coopers, I can almost guarantee that at least one listener is going to write into our comments page, well, if you don't want to do the time, don't do the crime.
Well, you know,
How widespread is that attitude?
That attitude is very widespread. I think that we as a society disappear the people into prison who we have no will to help, for instance, people with serious mental illness. Then we forget about them and we dismiss them with comments like, do the crime, do the time. The truth is, punishing people more harshly is not what we should be doing in prison. Rather, what's really important, the question we should all consider is what we do to them in prison going to make them more or less likely to abuse substances and commit further crimes when they're released? For sure, with all kinds of studies to back this up, I can say that putting people in solitary confinement breaks them, makes them more likely to use drugs and commit crimes when they're released, and is a very foolhardy program.
While you were preparing for your testimony in Disability Advocates Incorporated versus New York State Office of Mental Health, you write of meeting a man that you call Sam, a tall African-American man with wide eyes and an intense stare. What was his story?
Sam suffered from serious mental illness. The problem in solitary confinement with people who are suffering from serious mental illness is that the mental health staff will be overworked and oversubscribed. They will underdiagnose mental illness and start saying that the person is faking their symptoms. I see many, many people, including Sam, where the symptoms are authentic, and I do an examination and I find them authentic. But the prison mental health staff say the person is malingering.
So what happens if someone like Sam is then transferred to another facility? Is the new facility alerted to the fact that Sam may have problems?
Well, yes. And I have seen very many times that the dynamics between a particular prisoner and the staff are very noxious, and the individual is transferred to another facility where he doesn't have that record with the staff. The staff look at him and say, this individual needs mental health treatment, and they arrange mental health treatment, and the person does fine. So for instance, Mr. Walker, who we talked about a minute ago in Montana, he accumulated something like 150 disciplinary tickets, write-ups for bad behaviors, while he was in solitary confinement in Montana. But in Colorado, he had had almost no tickets. And I've seen people released from solitary confinement where they got repeated disciplinary write-ups. But in general population, after being released, they had no problem at all with the authorities.
You talk about a community model for treating prisoners. What's that? And how would it work?
Well, a therapeutic community is a novel idea brought into psychiatry by Maxwell Jones after the Second World War. The idea is that a big part of mental illness is lacking agency, that people lack agency, and because they lack agency, they despair, and they don't have the initiative to do much. So what you want to do in the treatment is to transfer as much decision-making authority to the patients. Grendon Prison in England has done that and made a therapeutic community inside a maximum security prison. And sure enough, the violence rate in that prison and the recidivism rate for people leaving the prison went way down.
You train mental health professionals who work in prisons and officers as well. How do you prepare them for the range of illnesses that they're going to encounter in the system?
Well, the first step, and I'm doing that here talking to you, is to remember that people who go to prison are just human beings like you and I. And they got in trouble usually when they were young and they were doing drugs. And prisoners today, I see 30, 35-year-old prisoners who I interview, and they say, look, when I was a kid, I did some stupid things. I'll take responsibility for it. However, I don't think I deserve to be tortured. So what first thing we have to do is create mutual respect between the staff who will be working with these individuals. Create what I call a rehabilitative attitude. A rehabilitative attitude is the mutual respect that is required in any kind of work like this. The plan to foster agency on the part of prisoners, the plan to help the prisoner envision a better future. And really, the alternative to solitary confinement is to develop that rehabilitative attitude on the part of the staff rather than a punitive, torture-oriented approach.
Well, we've been talking about hostility and tensions between prisoners and staff, but is there tension between corrections officers and mental health professionals in the prison?
Usually there is. Correction officers were not hired and did not plan on taking care of people with mental illness. They tend to have little patience for them, and they don't quite know what to do. So their reaction is to punish them. The emergence of solitary confinement has actually had a bad effect on staff's ability to care about the prisoners. Staff who pass a food tray through a slot in the door to a prisoner do not have the mutually respectful and caring attitude towards that prisoner that's needed to help them rehabilitate. Mental health staff, on average, are more sympathetic to the prisoners and treat them as patients. However, often they will be not allowed to do their work by the custody staff. For instance, when they ask to see a prisoner who's in solitary confinement, they'll say, I want to see him in a private setting where we can have some confidentiality. The staff will say, we don't have enough staff for that. You have to talk to him through the cell door. And that is not an ethical way to practice mental health care.
Is there a process through which a prisoner is put in solitary confinement? Or, in reverse, is there a process by which the prisoner is taken out of solitary?
I advocate strongly for total end of solitary confinement, and Commissioner Rick Ramage has accomplished that in Colorado. It is possible to do that.
So what do they do with somebody who's acting out, really being difficult, and is not necessarily because of mental health problems, but because he's just a really nasty person?
Well, the nasty person that you put in solitary confinement develops mental health problems. But the answer to your question is we need programs, alternative to solitary confinement, that are intensive mental health treatment at a very high level of security.
The sexual predator, for example, don't you want to put him into solitary confinement?
It depends. It depends on how immediate his predation tendency is. In other words, someone who's in prison because of a sexual related crime is not necessarily going to be a predator in prison. And they do need to be separated from potential victims. Separation is not the same as isolation. And again, what I advocate is rehabilitation, first with people who have been damaged by years in solitary. It needs to be intensive rehabilitation aimed to help them become social again. We've taken away their social skills. I call it a decimation of life skills. And we need to help them reinstate those capacities. It doesn't matter what someone's crime is. It is not true, as is imagined by the population at large, that people who go to prison with a terrible crime, for instance, an armed robbery, are necessarily violent in prison. There's no correlation about that. And everybody deserves a chance to clean up their act.
Terry Allen Cooper's is a professor emeritus at the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology. He is the author of a number of books, Prison Madness, now the book we've just discussed, Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. It is published by University of California Press, and thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. I've much enjoyed it.